John Schaedler has been with Dielectric 25 years and is currently the Director of Advanced Antenna Systems Development. After receiving his BS in Electrical Engineering from Penn State University, he began working for Dielectric Communications in New Jersey, formerly the RCA Antenna Division. He then obtained his master's degree in Electrical Engineering from Drexel University. His research and development achievements have been focused on unique TV, mobile media, FM cellular, wireless, and many other special bi-directional antenna designs. John has 41 issued and over 10 pending patents. In 2005, he was awarded the distinction of joining the ranks as one of SPX's master inventors. John Schaedler.
All right, so I'm going to talk about some advanced RF design and measurement tools. And that's actually a corporate template for SPX. It's not an advanced design tool, although you might think it could be. So who remembers, there we go, these days? The days of slotted lines and scale modeling, actually plotting on a Smith chart, far field testing, you know, T-squares and drawing boards. Well, they're pretty much all long gone. And they've been replaced by some pretty advanced tools. And today I'm going to be talking mainly about near field testing and electromagnetic simulation. So before I start, though, I got this trivia question. And for whoever can answer it, I got a $25 gift certificate to Starbucks and one of the most advanced CAD tools ever invented, the Etch-a-Sketch. So can anybody tell me what that tool is and why we would have used it for antenna testing? What's that?
It was a polar planimeter. It measured area with it.
Very good. Why would we use it for antenna testing?
We figured RMS of the patent.
You're pretty darn close.
It's still sitting
and you're our winner.
Yeah, we still have one in our office.
Thank you. So he's right. It's a polymeter. And basically, directivity or gain is related to an area underneath the curve when you measure a pattern of the antenna. So the only way that you could actually calculate the gain was basically measure the area under the pattern after you measured it. And that's what it was used for. So before I talk about near field, I'm going to jump back about 40 years and talk a little bit about far field. And for 40 years, RCA and Dielectric depended on far field testing for their broadcast antennas. So you can see in this picture, this is our near field or our far field range in Voorhees, New Jersey, for the RCA / Dielectric plant. Now, even though playing with this equipment was a lot of fun, especially using those plotter pens, you had to pump the little ball to get the ink to come out, and usually most of it was more in your shirt than on the paper. It has limitations. With a far field, the far field of a typical broadcast antenna is about a mile away, which means we had to have a transmit site a mile away, which took up a lot of real estate. You can only measure a single cut at a time. You know, as you spun this thing, spun the antenna, you basically could only measure a single cut. And once you got the pattern, you basically were left with no information about what to do to fix it or tune it. Does anybody recognize this guy in the picture? If you did any proposal work with us over the last 15, 18 years, you probably recognize it's not Paul McCartney, it's Ernie Mayberry. So in the early 90s, we replaced far field pattern testing with aperture probing, where we would sample the radio amplitude and phase along the aperture in the antenna. And then we take that sample data and basically calculate the far field based on array theory. This is one step better because it gave us some information along the aperture, and we could tell what we needed to do to basically tune the pattern, bring nulls up, beam tilt up, down, whatever needed to be done. But we were still limited to a single plane, and it only gave us information on the elevation pattern. There was no azimuth information. So here's the question. You know, is there a need for complete characterization of antenna patterns? You know, in the past, single, simple cuts seem to be accurate enough for most of the types of studies that we've done. But what about different types of situations, such as maybe DTS systems, areas where MPE limits could be of importance? For radiation exposure, the effect of mechanical beam tilt. And when you mechanically beam tilt the antenna, you can pretty easily tell what's happening in the front and the back and on the sides, but what's really happening in between. Or asymmetrical patterns. Let's say you have a panel antenna system where you have an odd number of panels on one face versus another face. What's really happening in between those faces? So in near field testing, we can get a lot more information. So what is near-field testing? Basically, you measure a cylinder of amplitude and phase, an imaginary cylinder, around the entire aperture of the antenna. And then we use Fourier transforms to convert that to the far field. Now let's take a look at the advantages of doing this. Now, as I said before, you know, far field range requires a lot of real estate, plus a transmitter site that's a mile away. You had to do elevation cuts with the antenna laying down, because that was the plane, you know, an elevation that you wanted to measure. With near field, you can stand that up. So not only do you not need the remote site, but you can stand the antenna up, saving a lot of real estate. And near field is not susceptible to multipath. You know, when you have a mile distance between the transmit and the receive site, you can have a lot of multipath. So it's a much more accurate, clean measurement. And once you take this data, you have a complete three-dimensional characterization of the antenna. Also of polarization information, you can extract any cut you want from that three-dimensional pattern. And also, you can take this data and not only use the transform to transform it to the far field, you can also back project it onto the surface of the antenna and use it as a diagnostic tool to make sure that the amplitude and phases along the aperture of the antenna are correct. Let's take a look at the two near field ranges that we have at SPX/dielectric. First one is an indoor chamber, where we have a 60-foot tapered anechoic chamber that has both far field and near field capability. We use this for a lot of scale modeling. We use it also for FM pattern studies. In broadcast, we use it quite often for characterizing individual panels. We also have an outdoor range, which has an 85-foot scanner, and we're capable of measuring antenna apertures of up to 15 feet and weighing over 10 tons. It's basically set up for a broadcast antenna. Measuring frequency range from 400 to 6 gig, and it's very accurate. The probe tolerance along this entire carriage is within a quarter of an inch, which means that antenna levels of minus 30 dB were within 2 dB accuracy. And this is the largest cylindrical near field in the US. That's the second largest in the world. There's one in the UK that's a few feet bigger, and if we knew that when we started, we probably would have cranked it up just to claim stake to that. So let me show you an example of a far field measurement. Here we have a 8-layer, basically a TFU, center-fed, slotted coaxial antenna for channel 25. These were actually the proposed patterns that we gave before the antenna was sold or designed, where it had a vertical component elliptically polarized, peanut-shaped pattern with about a 60-40 split in HV. An elevation pattern had a pretty heavy beam tilt of 2.2 degrees and an elevation gain of around 8.4. So the first thing we did was we used our conventional probing technique and related this measurement technique to our proposal, which is standard. That's what we do. We measured the azimuth pattern on a single layer, overlaid that with the proposed. As you can see, the patterns are pretty close. HV split is within a few percent of what we were shooting for. Gains were very close. Beam tilt through the main aperture, through the main main beam was good. First null was a little bit higher than what we predicted, which is not a bad thing. So then we moved on, took the same antenna, and put it on our near-field range, and did a complete near-field scan, which takes about 2 hours. But after that 2 hours, you've got all the information that you need to take any cut of the antenna. So what we saw here was that in terms of the azimuth pattern, looking at the main cut of the antenna, again, the azimuth patterns are pretty close, and the HV ratios were within a few, again, a few percent of where they're supposed to be. Beam tilt, beam width, and the main beam all matched up pretty well. First null a little bit higher, like we saw in the probing. But as you come down through the null structure, after about 15 degrees, you can see it's quite different than what we expected. So let's take a look at this, make some observations. First, the both the proposal and the probing technique basically looks at the aperture as a bunch of point sources and then uses a ray theory to calculate the far field. So you would assume that since both the proposed pattern, and that's the way everybody calculates patterns, by the way, and a probing technique would be pretty close in the null structure all the way out through, just using the same technique. But a near field basically uses the current distribution along the entire aperture of the antenna. So what you see is that, once you get out past about this 30 degree plus or minus 15 degree cone, that the pattern is quite a bit different than what you would expect calculating it with array theory. If you look at it, this is the same antenna, looking at it in three dimensions. And what you see here is that at large depression angles, down in here, which would be very close to the antenna, again, I'm talking about depression angles that are over 15 degrees, which is less than a mile in terms of coverage, or less than half a mile in terms of coverage at 1,000 feet, you can see that the pattern is distorted when you get close to the antenna. These lobes are not completely straight. So if you take that and you sort of look at it and what we're more used to looking at, in terms of the azimuth pattern, I'm going to look at it in different cuts. If you look at it at the 0 degree cut, which is basically on the main beam, you can see the peanut pattern is pretty well intact. You look at it at 10 degrees, the peanut pattern is pretty close. You start to get around 20 and 30 degrees, and you can see that that would be your coverage close to the antenna. It's actually distorted. Now, again, you have to take a look at these signal levels. These are, close to 30 dB down, and we're talking about very close to the antenna. Situations, again, where MPE limits might be of concern, or you need to know exactly what's going on in your very close coverage. There is one limitation to cylindrical near field, and that is the data starts to lose accuracy after the point of how far you can overscan and underscan. So if you can overscan and underscan by 45 degrees, which usually you can do more if your rail is long enough, your pattern is extremely accurate between minus 45 through the main beam to plus 45. But again, 45 degrees would be literally, 50, 100 feet from the antenna. So I'd like to move on to electromagnetic simulation. First of all, what is electromagnetic simulation? Well, basically it's doing RF development in a virtual environment, where you take a concept, you specify your geometry. Basically, if you can draw it, you can solve it. You choose materials, you choose your desired output. Are you looking at radiation type problems? Are you looking at enclosed problems like filters? And you can basically analyze behavior of the whole structure long before you build a prototype. The commercial tool we use is HFSS, High Frequency Structural Simulator, and we've invested over $500,000 in this tool with multiple solvers and processors and designer seats. So the advantages of electromagnetic simulation, obviously, you could, think right off your head, right off the bat, design time and design cost and prototype cost, because you're eliminating all this stuff. Material choices makes that a lot easier. And put all that together, it's time to market. And, we've been very successful in pretty much closing down what we called our old-timers arts and crafts lab group, who were masters with aluminum tape and tinfoil, and replaced it with electromagnetic simulation. So in the broadcast world, what we use electromagnetic simulation for is FM and TV pattern optimization. Obviously, new product development has a huge advantage there. RF components, such as power dividers, hybrids, and so on. Filter design, used extensively in filter design. And for FM pattern studies, using it more and more for that. There's a good reason for it, and I'll explain why in a second. Let's look at some examples. Here's a design of our elliptically polarized TUM panel, which basically what we do now, or currently, is we model an individual panel. Then we can go through what we call the designer stage, where the program actually takes those individual panels and puts it in any configuration you want. And it actually takes into account things like mutual coupling to get a true three-dimensional pattern. And we can optimize that pattern then by changing the geometry. This is done all in a virtual environment. Then we move on to making changes to the individual panel, say if it's circularly polarized, to get an HV ratio correct. And again, that goes through the same cycle so that any effect from the other panels that affects that HV ratio is taken into account. And finally, we tune that panel for the best VSWR, again, in the presence of all the other ones, and go right to production. And we've been very successful in having very little tuning time at the end of this process. So in FM pattern studies, we basically replaced our old scale model, trial and error method, with optometrics. Where basically you put in the constraints into the computer. You want the pattern to be within this footprint. And you want to have so many parasitics. And you have a plus or minus dimensions for the parasitics. And you let the computer do the optimizing. And the really nice advantage to this is that in the old days, once you had these parasitics set, some technician had to figure out where they were floating out there in free space and somehow transfer that information back to a designer. The designer had to put on an install drawing, which then went to the customer. Well, you can imagine there's a lot of room for error when you're trying to measure things just arbitrarily floating in free space. Well, with HFSS, you can basically take the solid model, dump it directly into Solid Edge, and it eliminates any of the chance of human error. So, in closing, I've got one last trivia question here. How many of you are familiar with RCA / Dielectrics traveling wave antenna? I see a couple hands. It was very, very popular, especially back through the 50s and 60s and 70s, for high-band VHF. It was a slotted coaxial design, which meant it had very low wind load. And it was obviously popular because we had shipped over 500 of these antennas for channels 7 to 13. So here's the question. First of all, back in 1955, Robert Masters, he filed for a patent on the traveling wave antenna, which was a great concept. But as the engineers soon found out, that with small pipe sizes, a slotted coaxial antenna's slot length wants to be much longer than a wavelength. So if you were to stack these slots up on a pipe, and if they were longer than a wavelength, you'd basically cut the pipe in half. They'd run right into each other. So they had a problem. So for 2 years, RCA had this team of engineers working on this problem. And in 1957, they made a breakthrough. They came up with this dog bone shaped slot, which allowed them to make the antenna or make the slot physically much smaller, but electrically look much bigger. So here's a question. How did this team of top RCA engineers come up with this brilliant idea? And after they did, why didn't they patent the idea? RCA patented everything, right? But this idea was never patented, and it was such a big breakthrough that you would think they would have. Does anybody know where they got the idea? Any guesses? What's that? RCA dog? The dog bone? I like that answer. Not right, but I like the answer. So again, we got the Starbucks gift certificate. And one of the most advanced 3D modeling tools ever invented, Legos. Any other guesses?
Armstrong.
NASA, no. Neil Armstrong? Howard Armstrong.
One of their kids.
No.
It looks like a top loading coil on a ham radio mobile with
that. No.
Somebody made a mistake.
Who's a mistake?
What's that?
It was a mistake.
A mistake? Yeah. No, they got the idea somewhere. No, but it's a cutout in something.
Was it violin?
Cutout in a game like Operation?
No.
Guitar?
Do you have a violin and guitar or a violin?
Oh. Ooh. You're the closest so far, so I'm going to give you the gift, and I'll give you the answer here. Well, as the story goes, one of those RCA engineers was watching a documentary about Aborigines in Africa. And what they were doing is they were taking logs and they were cutting dog bone-shaped slots in them, hollowing them out, cutting a dog bone-shaped slot. And when they beat the log, it resonated at a really low tone and they could communicate with other tribes miles away. So it occurred to the engineer, really low tones? You can make a slot resonate at very low frequencies. Went back to the lab, and they tried it, and it worked. So, turns out, the reason why they didn't patent it, because the idea wasn't so original. They've been using it for, hundreds of thousands of years. So, anyway, that's the answer to the story. And in closing, I'd like to say that, advanced tools are essential for technical analysis, but obviously, they can't replace creativity. Thank you. Any questions?
How long ago have you been using these tools now?
The near field ranges we've had for almost 3 years. HFSS The early versions we were actually using back around year 2000, but they weren't very friendly. I mean, it's really only been in the last probably 4 years that we've really depended on it in a design stage.
Okay.
How do you go about modeling VHF antennas if your near field was only 470 to 80 something?
Scale modeling.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just not practical to do near field testing for VHF. The problem is not the fact the near field's pretty close, because 2D squared over lambda, you're dividing by a bigger wavelength, so that's not the problem. The problem is the probe. You have to have that probe running on the rail, and a VHF probe is enormous. So you got the problem of, you know, accuracy with the thing, you know, bouncing or and just the sheer size. But we would do a lot of scale modeling in that case.
Scale?
What's that? No, we use, I think FM is 4.7 to 1, something like that. Use very little 10 to 1 scale. That just gets too small. Get one more.
I have one final comment, if I may. Are you saying that the discovery of that dog bone slot for the antenna was a logarithmic solution?
That's good. Thank you. Yeah.